Welcome to PageCast, a podcast series brought to you by Jonathan Bull Publishers, aimed to give you the story behind the story. By interviewing the authors responsible for some of your most loved books, we explore the thoughts, ideas, emotions, and creative processes that led to the writing of these books. If you're a reader with a zesty interest in people and stories, do stick around and enjoy what PageCast has to offer.
Great. So my name is Lorenza Eckard. I'm a journalist and presenter for an actuality program called In Gesprek on Kijknet, Monday nights at 8:30. I'm also a big fan of Fred and the work that he's done, the books that he's written. This is not my first conversation with him, but I'm very excited to have this specific conversation about the fantastic book that he's written, The Gorilla and the Journalist, Exploring the Murderous Legacy of Jonas Savimbi. So I'm going to throw it over to Fred now to give us a bit of an introduction to who he is, to the listeners that might not know Fred and the work that he's done, and he can just tell us a bit more about himself.
I've been a foreign correspondent all my working life in Brussels, in Scotland, in London, in the Middle East, in India and Pakistan, and also in Southern Africa. I've written several books, particularly about Angola, but not only about Angola. I've written a couple of books about Winnie Mandela, and I've actually written a book about the first Green Party in Britain. And I'm currently writing a book about an aid organisation in Scotland, which is all about good people rather than about bad people, and I've tended to write about bad people in the past.
All right, Fred, I think that sets us up very nicely. I think on that note, my first question would be that you've just referred to the many books that you have written, and this is your second book specifically about Savimbi, about Jonas Savimbi. How does this one differ to the first one that you wrote, Jonas Savimbi, A Key to Africa?
In the early parts, it doesn't differ a lot. It goes over some of the old ground covered in my original book, and that was very sympathetic to Savimbi. And I'd been encouraged to write it by my friend Tito Chingunji, who was the foreign secretary of UNITA. This book develops the story because I began to learn some very alarming facts about Savimbi, which were at variance with what I'd written before. Or not so much about, yes, they were at variance with what I'd written before, but these new facts were very alarming, and they were so serious that I realized I had to write about them and reveal them to the wider public.
Before we get to Savimbi, I'd like to just take a moment to talk about the title of the book, The Gorilla and the Journalist. And on the cover, we see a picture of two gorillas. So before we do get to Savimbi, tell us a bit about your relationship with Tito Chingunji. Who was Tito, and why did he leave such a mark, not only on you as a journalist and as an individual, but also as an observer of history in Southern African politics at that time?
Well, Tito Chingunji was a member of one of the founding families of the UNITA movement. He was the son of Jonathao Chingunji, who jointly founded UNITA with Savimbi. And Tito was a very charming young man who rose rapidly through the ranks of UNITA. I was with Tito and with UNITA when they were retreating in front of the Cubans, and it looked as though, retreating in front of the Cubans in January 1976, and it looked as though they were going to be wiped out. And I got out on the last plane from their territory before they went on a long march into the interior to begin a new battle against the Cubans, sort of repeating what they'd done against the Portuguese in the past. And as I got onto the plane, Tito said, "If we survive, maybe you'll write a book about us one day." And I, I laughed, and I never expected to see him again, ever. And 4 years later, I was in Edinburgh, in my home, when I was asked to take a reverse charges call from Morocco. And on the end of the line, Tito said, "Mr. Bridgeland, it's Tito, and we've survived. And you remember that promise you made to write a book about us?" And I laughed, because it hadn't been a serious promise. But anyway, I was intrigued, and I traveled to Morocco to see Tito and Savimbi, where they were at that time. And I began to get involved again with the reporting of what was happening. And I did three long treks of hundreds of miles with the guerrillas across Angola. So that's how I met Tito. And then I subsequently met him many times, and he became a very close friend of my family. He used to stay in my house in Edinburgh a lot. And then when I moved to London, he stayed with us in London. And then when I moved to Brussels, he spent a long time in Brussels, and we became very, very close.
And obviously Tito is very close to Savimbi. Tell us a bit about those times that you did link up with Tito and Savimbi and UNITA in Angola back then, because you write quite beautifully about the weeks on end that you spent with UNITA, with Savimbi, with Tito, some of the other guerrillas in the bush. The various challenges that you experienced during that time. I think that makes out for fascinating reading.
Well, I told Tito, look, if I'm going to write this book, I'm going to have to travel with the guerrillas and see what they're doing. And I began traveling to Angola and linking up with various commanders of the guerrilla army, and then walking hundreds of miles northwards through the bush in southeastern Angola. And really, it was the most exhilarating experience, because the area Angola was, the area UNITA was operating from, was one of the great wildlife, unfenced wildlife reserves of Africa. So there were huge herds of elephant and buffalo and zebra and giraffe and sable antelope. It was just beautiful. And you know, it was an area where there were no tarred roads, there were no towns in the conventional sense, and I was beginning to see areas of Angola which many people had not had the privilege of seeing, because it was so wild and remote. And so I, each time I went, I teamed up with a different guerrilla commander. I would march with them through Angola to their targets, and then be there as they attacked the towns held by the MPLA.
As a journalist, that was very interesting to me, the way that you were able to report and the many days and weeks that you were allowed to spend with this group. That's something that I don't think would be possible today in a modern newsroom. And in a way, the book is sort of a throwback to, I wouldn't say the glory days of foreign reporting or war reporting, because I don't think that you try to romanticize that in any way in the book. But in a way, it does sort of talk to an era, bygone era of foreign reporting.
I think that's right, and I think the crucial example of the era of what you describe as bygone reporting was how I discovered the secret South African military invasion of Angola. These days, I wouldn't have been able to discover that invasion, because there's such instant communication between reporters in the field and their foreign editors. And I was only able to discover the South African invasion of Angola because I flew into Angola, realized the South Africans had invaded, and then I spent 3 weeks wandering around southern Angola, managing to get a lift into the heart of the South African operation in Rundu. So for those 3 weeks, I was completely out of touch with my foreign desk and my foreign editor. Now, these days, if I arrived, the moment I walked down the steps of the plane and set foot on Angola, I would be getting a call on my cell phone from the foreign editor, and they would say, "Fred, when are you going to start filing your first story?" And they'd be continually pestering me. But I needed those 3 weeks to pin down the story properly. And it was very exciting. I mean, I was having the time of my life. It was fascinating. But I was free from any control from my foreign desk. And that today is impossible.
Fred, talk to us a bit about your initial interactions then with Savimbi. What kind of impression did he make on you initially when you spoke to him or you met him the first time?
He made a great impression. It was quite exciting. I mean, you know, he was 41 at the time. He was very fit. He oozed charm. He was charismatic. He was warm. He had a legendary reputation among the people of Central and Southern Africa. He was the only liberation leader to base himself inside Angola when they fought the Portuguese. It was just very, very, very romantic. I mean, he was a brilliant public speaker. I mean, really brilliant. I mean, everybody who saw Savimbi addressing a crowd confirmed that what a brilliant orator he was. He knew classical Ovimbundu, the local language. He knew all the proverbs. He was a man of immense energy. He was a very clever man, an incredible intellectual. He spoke many languages. He spoke fluent English, for example, although he'd never lived in an English-speaking country. And he was just very interesting to talk to. I mean, I had conversations with him which lasted for hours. I was just very impressed by him.
The impression that I got in the book as well was that Savimbi was very keenly aware of where Angola was in that post-colonial era. And that he was sort of not just a keen observer of what Angolans perhaps wanted, what their aspirations were, but that, you know, later as we found out that he sort of abused that aspiration that Angolans had for freedom, independence, and for good governance, which were promises that were made to them. But you also sort of write about Savimbi's exposure to Che Guevara and various other communist leaders. What kind of impact did that make on him as a freedom fighter?
I think he was very impressed by his meeting with Guevara. It was quite short. I mean, he had one meeting with him in Tanzania, another meeting with him in Algeria when Guevara had been trying to sort of repeat the Cuban Revolution in the Republic of the Congo. But Guevara obviously liked Savimbi, and he encouraged him to go into Angola, fight his battle against the Portuguese from within Angola, not from outside, and to live with the people. That's exactly what Savimbi did. I mean, Savimbi fought the Portuguese from inside Angola, and none of the other liberation movements did that.
I don't want to give too much away, but there's a section in the book, you meet Tito years after you wrote your first book, where he sort of tells you that perhaps you were under, perhaps not the correct impression regarding Savimbi's role and how he was conducting himself as leader of UNITA. Tell us a bit about that meeting that you had with Tito, because it's a lot of emotional language that you use in the book, and it is quite heartbreaking.
It was a very difficult thing. What happened was that I had published my first book about Savimbi, which I'd written in close cooperation with Tito, And one day I was in my office, I was in London at the time, I was a diplomatic editor of my paper, and I got a call from Washington, because Tito was based in Washington for UNITA as foreign secretary, liaising with the American government and with the CIA. And he said, "Fred, I need to talk to you." I said, "Well, go ahead." He said, "No, I don't. I can't talk to you on the phone." I said, "Well, where do you want me to talk to you?" He said, "I'd like you to come to Washington." I said, "Tito, I'm not in the habit of just... No, Tito, tell me what it's about." And he said, "No, I can't tell you." I said, "Tito, I'm not in the habit of just hopping on planes and crossing the Atlantic for casual chats with my friends." He said, "You must come. You must come." And I said, "What's this about?" He said, I can't tell you." I said, "Is this a matter of life or death?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Okay, I'm on my way." And then I met him in a hotel room in central Washington. And he began to describe to me some of the awful things, really evil things, that Savimbi was doing to his own people and to Tito's own family, and how he was blackmailing Tito. He had his whole extended family in Jamba, the UNITA headquarters, and he was holding them as hostages against Tito continuing to do a brilliant diplomatic job in Washington. And so Tito was sort of trapped in a moral dilemma I think of as being of Kafkaesque proportions. It's a moral dilemma that was created by Savimbi's threats to the people that Tito loved. And so Tito described a lot of these atrocities to me. He described to me how Savimbi had killed his own parents, Tito's own parents, who had questioned Savimbi's morals, because the book, and I'm not giving anything away here, I mean, Savimbi had innumerable wives and concubines who he stole from other people, and Savimbi's children were littered across southern Africa, southern Angola. And some of these women who he took as concubines, Savimbi later murdered. And one of the stories Tito was telling me was this infamous witch burning in September 1983, when Savimbi actually burned several women and their children on a public bonfire in Jamba, accusing them of being witches. But in fact, most of them were women who had refused to sleep with Savimbi. I mean, this was horrific, horrific stuff. I said to Tito, I said, "Look at this. I don't want to tell you one of my best jokes, because you might publish it." I said, "You're telling me what I've written in the first book, that it's my first novel." I said, "What do I do with this now? What am I going to have? Because I'm going to have to do something." And he said, "Well, look, at first, just hold on and don't do anything at the moment. But I will give you a signal when the time is right to write about it. Or," and this put a huge responsibility on my shoulders, "or you will know the time has come to write about it." So I flew back from Washington, knowing that at some point I was going to have to write about Savimbi, the mass murderer of his own people, destroying his own movement, and that this man who I had admired, I liked, I mean, I liked Savimbi, but clearly he was, beneath all this charm, he was just evil and that he had no internal moral control. And then I got back to London and was thinking about things and how do I begin to carry this forward, when people began ringing me and said, look, we're very worried about Tito at the moment, because he's gone back to Jamba against all our advice, and he hasn't come back to do his job in Washington. And he's got several very important appointments, particularly with members of black churches who Tito had been working with. And the people who phoned, they said, would you be willing to go to Jamba and see if Tito's all right? Because we think Savimbi is... We think that you're probably the only person whom Savimbi might be prepared to listen to. I said, okay, I'll go. I went, and I was put on a kind of trial in the big meeting hut called a jungle in Jamba. And Savimbi made me sit down next to him, and then the whole Politburo was in front of me, including Tito. And Savimbi welcomed me. He was the traditional warm Savimbi who I had known, and he said, "Just tell us why you've come." I said, "Well, you know, I've come because people are worried in the outside world why Tito hasn't returned to his job in Washington, and they asked me to come here." And I said, I was prepared to come because, you know, Tito had helped me write the original Savimbi book. And I said, in the course of writing that, I'd come to regard him as my brother. Oh, that was a big error. Savimbi exploded, and he just shouted at me and insulted me for about an hour. And he said, and he waved his arm around the Politburo, and he said, you're not Tito's brother. These are Tito's brothers, the people who have been fighting colonialism and white rule for years and years. And now you come here and you insult me. And he called me a racist. And I think the worst insult was that he said your book may be very thick, but in the history of our movement, it is a very thin thing. So anyway, these insults were poured at me.
I guess is it an unfair question to ask you before that meeting? As a journalist, did you have no suspicions of this sort of other side that Savimbi had during your earlier dealings with him?
No, none whatsoever. It came as a complete shock and surprise. And it's true of most people. I mean, Leon Dash, who had the Washington Post correspondent who did two huge journeys with UNITA across Angola, he said he had no suspicions at all about these aspects of Savimbi. He managed to cover things up brilliantly. The moment I realized that there was this other side of Savimbi which had not been seen before, I resolved to write about it. From that moment, I said, "Right, this has got to be written about. I didn't see it as a new story. I saw it as the development of a story. I mean, that's one of the prices of journalism. You know, you can do so much that is superficial. I mean, and I consider most of the journalism we do, I think it's just wallpaper. But I mean, if you're really going to write something in depth, you've got to stick with the story, because there are hidden depths to stories which you can only get at if you stick with the story for a long time. And that's what I think I did. Suddenly I was confronted with new truths, and I wrote about them. And as a consequence of them, I actually had death threats. And my partner, Sue Armstrong, she had threats from Savimbi's thugs to mutilate her. So there were consequences of writing what I call the developing story, not the new story, but the developing story.
Certainly. Fred, I just, as a last question, would like to ask you about the experience of being a European writing about African issues and politics, especially in that era, because there's a section in the book where you talk about the sort of purchase of a Eurocentric package deal about any group in Africa. And then you write, nothing on the continent is as straightforward at close range as it seems from afar. Do you think that still holds true?
I think it's absolutely true. I mean, look at the continent I live on. I mean, you know, until recently, we were all pinky greys. I never described myself as a white. I described myself as a pinky grey. We were all pinky greys. You couldn't say that there was some sort of uniform culture in Europe because everybody was pinky grey. We were a whole range of cultures, a whole range of languages. And the same was true of Angola. I mean, Angola had... Do you know it had 100 distinct ethnic groups in Angola, 46 different languages? It was unique in itself, and it deserved to be considered as unique in itself rather than as part of some overall African image.
Fred, thank you so much, and thank you for updating the story and writing this book about the very important part of Angola's history. I'm certainly very thankful to you.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of PageCast. We have an incredible lineup of author interviews, so head over to our Facebook and Instagram and follow Jonathan Ball Publishers to stay updated and in the know regarding future episodes. Thanks for your interest in the story behind the story. Happy reading from everyone at PageCast.